This is a Crazy Over 40s Live podcast, where every Thursday you will have a pirouette of rotating co-hosts, including myself, Caroline Brown, that will delve into topics relating to the over 40s. Throw away this notion that you're going through a midlife crisis. We're going for a crazy over 40s life. It's the time to uncover and rebirth our adolescent years filled with curiosity and all our desires. We do it right here on the Crazy Over 40s Live podcast. We look into relationships, emotional, sexual, financial wellness, entrepreneurship, providing you with an enjoyable delivery every Thursday. And don't forget to share and subscribe so you can keep updated on all the episodes as and when they become available. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to our podcast today. We shall be discussing a very sensitive topic, a taboo topic about love, sex and porn addiction. Very rarely do we say it in the same sentence, but here today we're going to be delving into the complexities of this. Now, many different factors that can contribute to someone developing an addiction to love, sex or pornography. And I will go on to explain a few potential explanations. It could be neurochemical factors. You know, love, sex, and pornography all have the ability to trigger the release of dopamine in the brain, which can create feelings of pleasure and reward. And for some individuals, it can lead to a cycle of repeating the behavior in order to experience the same rush of pleasure again. Not forgetting childhood trauma or emotional issues. Sometimes people turn to love, sex and pornography as a way to numb emotional pain or to fill a void by unresolved childhood trauma or emotional issues and societal and cultural influences. Our society plays a lot of emphasis on sex and love and pornography. This day and age, the digital age, it can be easy for someone to feel pressure to engage in these behaviors, to fit in, to feel validated. And not forgetting genetics, you know, family history, there seem to be some genetic factors that may play a role for someone may be prone to addiction. Whatever the complexity, whatever the source, it's important to know that addiction is a complex issue, and I'm not expecting it to be resolved in today's episode or come to a conclusion. But what we will do in today's episode is to delve into the complexities of this all, you know, the complexities of relationships, into the science of human sexuality a little, and offer practical strategies for those struggling with porn, love and sex addiction. We believe on this episode today, when we shall be joined by Gary, who is a therapist, and we shall be having a conversation about these topics and how essential it is for personal growth and the healing. So join us to navigate the often misunderstood worlds of love, sex and porn addiction. And we shall be joined by Gary McFarlane, who is a therapist, and this is his niche. This is his work. He does this day in and day out. You won't be disappointed. So join us after the interlude. And like always, don't forget to share and subscribe so you can keep updated on all the episodes as and when they become available. And I'm your host, Caroline Brown. Listeners, as I said to you before, we shall be joined with Gary. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Caroline. Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's lovely to have you on. We are going to talk about some of the things that people just don't have the courage to talk about for all the reasons that you're going to share with us right now. I've given you a little bit of an introduction, but I would love for you to kind of extend on that. So tell my listeners a little bit why you got into the work that you do.
I think so many of us as counsellors, as therapists, are wounded souls who have done their own journey to find healing. And so I actually was the lawyer of lots of decades, the solicitor, and stuff happens. Life doesn't go as one plans it from A to Z. and there are detours. And so I had to really deal with my own issues. Interestingly enough, it wasn't sex, porn, love addiction. It was actually attachment issues of being born abroad, parents coming to this country when I was just 18 months old, but I didn't see them again till age six. And that really went on to have quite a catastrophic impact, actually, on my life in how I did relationships with other people in terms of keeping them at arm's length so as not to be hurt again. And so I did a career shift eventually in order to become a therapist rather than the solicitor, a very different income stream. But very much trained with relates at the heart of what I do, relationship issues. So I work with singles, I work with pre-marrieds, those wanting to prepare for marriage. I work with partners, couples, marrieds, and the long time marrieds. So I'm a psychosexual therapist. I abbreviate that to sex therapist, and I specialize a lot really in sex, porn, love addiction. I work with that area quite a lot. It really is impacting children as young as age 10, right up to the 75-year-old. And I'm an EMDR practitioner, eye movement desensitization reprocessing practitioner, where I'm helping people to deal with traumas, not just trauma, but anxiety, stress, pain, unresolved, unprocessed stuff from their past 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And the EMDR has proven really, really helpful for resolving past issues.
Yeah. And so that brings me on nicely to the conversation about why do people search for love, but in a very addictive way?
And there are different ways they're searching for love. Some are novels and escape into the fantasy of the novel. Some are dating sites, some various social media sites. But what I call love is not so much love, Caroline. It's actually seeking to find connection. And in having interaction and connection, they're finding a sense of being wanted by somebody. And that sense of being wanted, being held, being cared for, given attention by somebody gives a sense of love and affection, which fills a void and what we call an insecure attachment void, which gets set up back there in childhood. And it really does have to do with the disruption in the bonding with those key, we call them caregivers, but typically a mother, a father. Something happens where the bonding gets disrupted and the child feels a sense of being rejected, let go, detached. That has profound impacts into their adulthood, so that the way they do, way we do adult relationships is coming out of that childhood stuff. Gosh.
It's a lot. I mean, when you think about love addiction, because that's what it's about, love addiction, it being an attachment disorder, it's obviously can be not only kind of suffering for the person, because the person is in great need, aren't they, for something that they feel is a void in their life. And because it's so crippling, it can have a massive impact on self-esteem, isn't it? And the feeling of feeling worthless if they're not in a relationship or some kind of a relationship.
There's a void that's just set up yet again. And the brain is feeling pain of that void as it felt with the detachment that happened back there in childhood. You know, Caroline, as you were speaking, I was thinking, well, you and I are therapists. We can go straight into talking about this thing called attachment. But actually, I wonder if the listeners even know what this thing is. Because I often say, attachment isn't what's on the label, on the can. It's a strange term to use because actually it's exactly the opposite. It's detached. It's a sense of loss that the infant in early years experiences because, and it could just be the bonding that never took place as well as it could have done because of postnatal depression, because of the child, the baby when born, being put in the intensive care, because of the emotional unavailability of a mum, of a dad, because of being put up for adoption, fostering, because of being sent to boarding school at quite a young age. The brain experiences a separation that it just didn't want to have, and it experiences it as pain. Now, it's more complex than that and very individualistic in how that void gets set up. But the brain didn't like the pain of that separateness and separation or lack of good enough bonding. And now it learns to self-protect itself in how it goes on to allow us to do relationships with other people.
And it'd be good to actually talk about the different styles of attachment or attachment style theory, as plain as possible.
Wow.
and that comes with, you know, there are, so, you know, depend on what you subscribe to, but essentially there are sort of four types of attachment styles, yeah. Aren't they? There's a secure, the avoidant, the anxious, and the disorganized. Tell me, what does the avoidant look like and what does the anxious look like, would you think?
So we talk about four, but what I do is I put on my left hand is what I call the secure attachment, the ideal outcome, the good enough bonding. It's not about perfection. It's that the brain experienced it as a good enough experience. And so the individual is able to go on and do their relationships in a good, positive way. Because what actually happens for those who don't experience it in a good enough way, on the right-hand side, are these three insecure attachment styles. And that's what I take my clients through. Now, different articles will show them, will give them slightly different names. So
right.
One of them would be the anxious preoccupied, as it's called. People with this style they agree with this statement. I want to be completely emotionally intimate with others, but I often feel that others are reluctant to get as close as I would like. And I'm uncomfortable being without close relationships, but I sometimes worry that others won't value me as much as I value them. And so there's something of I'm anxious and preoccupied. And I want to get close. I call it a push me, pull you. You know, I love you. I want somebody to own me and to love me and care for me. But when they get too close, I can go on to push people away. Because I'm fearful that the relationship might end and I'll be hurt again.
Hurt again, which is very opposite to the kind of secure, isn't it? Because the secure, you know, you're able to regulate your emotions.
Yes.
The trusting of others come a little bit more easier.
Yes.
And you're able to communicate and you're not always in seek of emotional support in a way as someone, as you describe in that situation.
Absolutely.
And it goes on, and connecting and conflict, self-esteem, and being most importantly as well, emotionally available.
Absolutely. Emotionally available. You know, the other one is what's called the dismissive avoidant. This style is really one of, people with this type of style will say, I am comfortable without close emotional relationships. It's actually really important to me to feel independent and self-sufficient. I prefer not to depend on others or others depend on me. I talk about, these are individuals that really have become little adults as young individuals because they were nurtured to be able to really just take care of themselves and not be dependent on others. And of course, you can see, can't you, Caroline, how that's going to play itself out in adulthood, where I don't need you, I don't need you, I can stand alone. Yet, as human beings, we were designed to be in relationships with other people. We actually do want close relationships where I feel held, but the individual actually gets a bit jittery when there's conflict. So they may actually throw hand grenades in and blow up the relationship because they fear it might be ending. And of course, it's much better to blow it up and end it myself, so the brain feels as a defense mechanism, than if it's done to me and I'm caught off guard and I get hurt again, like happened in the past in childhood when somebody didn't hold me close enough, didn't bond with me well enough. Some strange things, but it's the brain's way of trying to protect us from hurt again. And that last one, the last of the insecure attachment styles, is that fearful avoidant. And people with this style tend to be ones really that have experienced trauma and things like sexual abuse in childhood, because they're somewhat uncomfortable getting close to others. Yet the contradiction is they want emotionally close relationships, but they find it difficult to be completely trusting of that person because, of course, the brain is carrying the pain of the past and the hurt and the abuse and the like. And so the brain is trying to negotiate this really tricky terrain where, as human beings, we're designed to be in relationship with others, but because of some event back there in childhood, we need to protect ourselves from being hurt by people we want to be in close relationship with. So the individuals with insecure attachment, their brain finds ways to manage the relationship, control the relationship, make sure they don't get hurt again. And that, of course, is going to create some big issues in the relationship.
And as you talked about, all from trauma, bad relationships. And I know you talked about before with me, hormones and genetics playing a part, but let's look at, you know, how trauma plays a part, as you just mentioned, and how that can lead to them feeling, someone feeling that their self-esteem and self-worth is at the core of them seeking out love and sex in the wrong places with the wrong people at times. And, you know, when you talk about relationships as well, is that past experience, they will struggle to form healthy relationships because that's all they know. That's all they know, the relationships that they have suffered before, if it was a very poor relationship. When we talk about hormones and genetics, how important is that when it comes to love or any kind of addiction, really?
Let me say, first of all, that the very fact that probably over 90% of my clients will come with this an insecure attachment style. In other words, it's a big issue for the population at large. Something happened back there that disrupted bonding, even if you can't see it. I came from a really happy, good family, etc. The vast majority of my clients will have an underlying insecure attachment style. And that disruption is itself trauma. It's self-trauma. Why? Because the brain is now doing life in adulthood as a way of trying to avoid repeat of hurt. And so it's still carrying the hurt, and the hurt is at the level of trauma. Mm-hmm. So just be aware of that. In terms of hormones and genetics, I'd need to make sure we're on the same page, really. What do I think when I think of hormones? I think, well, and genetics, it depends what you are talking about, I think, here, Caroline. I don't want to dive in and make assumptions that I think I understand how you are using those terms and how I might be using those terms.
Sure. I mean, they may be some people have higher hormone levels than others, and that can affect sort of their sex drive, I would assume. And so that can contribute to excessive sexual activity. Mm-hmm. And then when we talk about genetics and disposition, could possibly play a huge part in development of sex and love addiction. When you think about genetic traits you inherit from your parents, with any addiction, really. How vulnerable can someone be if they have a family member at some point who may have been addicted to something? And in this case, obviously, love and sexual addiction.
I think as a sex porn love addiction therapist, it's quite a specialized area, as well as a psychosexual therapist, which I abbreviate to a sex therapist. I would want to move away from people having labels about hormone and genetics, actually, Caroline. Why? Because the minute we put people in a box, then they will inevitably have to write themselves off as not fixable because it's all about my hormones and my genetics. And of course, I can't do anything about those things. So I might as well just pack my bag and give up now. And that's why I'd rather move away from that type of label and say, actually, that may play some part. But when, as a sex therapist, I never join people talking about whether it's he or she having a high sex drive and the other has a low sex drive. I just, as a sex therapist, I don't join that conversation because it's a label. What you've got to do is look at the underlying lots of other dynamics and issues that have caused one individual to be given that label, which they must continue to wear, mustn't they? Because that's what's showing itself out. And I say, no, it's not necessarily hormonal at
Okay.
all. It will start to show itself as a reason and an excuse, maybe, but it's more complex than that. It's and the time to unpick this one, I think the best I can say is people stop labeling yourself with high sex drive, low sex drive, hormonal genetics. It's much more than that, and so often it is something to do with what has shaped us from childhood development, because there are scripts that get handed on, just like the baton in a relay race, which we must take the baton as children. We've never lived life on this planet before, and the significant place that is going to be shaping us is the family home, whatever that looks like, and a baton is being handed on, and we take the baton. There are scripts and lots of things that will be shaping us. And hormones and genetics is only one facet.
So very clearly you've explained is that your thought on it all. I mean, there are people who subscribe to that, but what you're saying is that it's a lot more than that.
It is. You
Okay.
don't, you're not fixable, and that's not true.
Yeah.
It's just not true. That's why I don't want to join a conversation like that, because there's a lot more things to look at as to how somebody ends up with a label like that. And the label doesn't mean, therefore, not fixable, not sortable. It's not true. Don't buy into the lie.
The lies, yes. So what do you see? Do you see men and women? So these are some of the things that I wanted to clear up today. With love addiction, what does that look like for someone if they're addicted?
Yeah, they're not chasing love as such. They're chasing the sense of being wanted and held and cared for, to fill that attachment void that they're trying to fill. But it's an insatiable black hole. You can't fill it. No matter how much sex and interaction with others you get, it's as if they're a sieve that leak, and a week or two later, they're still searching for something else to fill that void. It just can't get filled. What you've got to do is go back and deal with the deficit that got set up back there in childhood, that set up the insecure attachment. It will never be met with the amount of sex and connections, because one person can't fill that void at all. But individuals will try and try and try, but get hurt.
That would get hurt. What are the signs? What are the signs that you are addicted to sex and love?
You're going to see repeated behaviors that look like searching sex, doing porn, doing you're going to see, and the individual is going to have a sense of not being able to stop when they have tried to stop in the past. So I have got a definition of sex addiction. I use a different definition for love addiction, but if we just start with the sex addiction
Okay.
definition, I think that probably starts to give a sense of understanding, really. So the definition of sex addiction: a pattern of sexual behaviors which preoccupy your thoughts and are out of control. You cannot stay stopped for a sustainable period or consistently, and it has harmful consequences, and the behavior serves a function in your life, and it is used primarily to anesthetize some negative feeling state to move you essentially from one negative way you're feeling into a more positive way of feeling. So the most important part of the criteria, which makes it an addiction rather than just a love of sex, is actually that it serves a function. So I do an extensive history taking to build a profile of the individual from the time they were born up to the age that they are, because what I'm trying to find is what is the role, the function, the purpose which the behavior serves in their life, because it does serve a role, it does serve a function in their life, and that's what you're trying to find. And those with a love addiction are using perhaps sex, whether it's porn or any form of behavior, and that's what people are seeing. But actually, it's all about the interaction with other people. In other words, those with love addiction don't tend to restrict their activities to just viewing porn in a closed door in isolation on their own. They tend to be interacting with other people in one form or another, even if it's webcam, because there's a sense of being wanted by the person on the other side of the screen, even if you're paying for it from a prostitute. Any attention is better than no attention. So the love addiction is all about trying to get connection with somebody, because that gives a sense of being wanted and temporarily fills a void, not for very long, before the emptiness comes back. Go in search, but they keep getting hurt, but they get up and go back and do it again. And often for women, they'll give away sex because there's a sense of being loved and wanted. The male may take the sex, but then he's gone after a while. She's hurt, very hurt. But eventually she gets up again and she finds other ways to go in search of that ideal person that's going to want her, hold her, love her, care for her. But she keeps getting hurt because she's actually trying to fill a deficit, a void that got set up there in childhood. And there's something about, let's do some work, first of all, to deal with the void, to deal with the attachment issues, the insecure attachment.
When you talk about the insecure attachment, there's a void, and you talk about the feeling of her or him feeling quite empty as a result of that. What other ways can it manifest in someone? How does someone recognize when they're actually kind of harming themselves through wanting to do this?
They may not recognize it. They're in them because it probably others will recognize it and try and show it to them. But this is me being me, doing life how I do life. What's the problem? So they may not readily recognize it. So I think probably, first of all, they need to read something about somebody else, and maybe they'll then be able to say, oh gosh, that looks like the type of behaviors that I've been doing. So I myself had an attachment, insecure attachment, because of the age 18 months, parents come into England leaving me back there with the extended family, aunties, grandparents. But my baby brain, which is pre-verbal, must have known there is this person called a mother that wasn't giving me breast milk and eye connection and was gone. And I would have cried and cried and cried and cried and cried and got over it eventually. And then I didn't see her or my father again till age 6. But I didn't know who these people were. And so my brain recognized the void, but I didn't necessarily. And yet I had learned to do relationships in a way that kept people at arm's length. I didn't share me deeply or become vulnerable with anyone because my brain was trying to protect me. And the contradiction is, as human beings, we're designed to be in relationships with other people. So we want somebody for ourselves to own, to love, etc. But it's then dangerous to get near anyone. And so often you're going to see it in a fight, conflict situation. And the other person might be scratching their head, the other person in the partnership, and not understanding. You know, it's sort of push me, pull you. Sometimes you want me close, then another time you push me away, and then you want me close, then you push me away. And they don't understand the dynamics, because what often takes place in early relationships, I call it the bucking horse. The person with the insecure attachment is going to potentially give the new partner a hard time, a bit like they're bucking, and yet they want them, but they're bucking and kicking. What they're doing is sort of testing the partner to see if they're going to stay. And ultimately, if I've bucked long enough and you've come back and you've stayed, then I'll put a ring on it, because I've proven you, and you will never leave me, will you? And if I get a sign of you potentially about to go, I might get jittery and start to throw hand grenades in to blow it up and push you away. And yet, you never going to, were you? It's because I pushed you away. And then, of course, the brain sees a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is, I knew you were going to leave. I knew it. I knew you weren't. I knew it. And actually, they weren't probably going to leave. It's us that pushed them away because we feared being finished with and let go of, and we weren't in control of that. Did that make some sense?
And no, absolutely, it made a lot of sense. And I'm sure to my listeners too, when you talk about love and sex addiction, and you talk about different types, how it will manifest itself, you talked about porn, and it's, for me, it's quite clear if someone is using that porn. And the reason why they become addicted. And first of all, I want to ask, is to watch porn ever okay?
Ooh, that's asking me to make a moral and ethical judgment.
Well, okay, let me say another way.
Oh, it's okay to ask it.
Oh, and you are. Okay, you're going to answer. Okay,
I just waffle around it and avoid answering the question because I don't want to moralize. What as a sex therapist, when I did sex therapy training a lot of years ago, you know, getting close to 20 years, 15 years ago, in the earliest part of the training was to let us watch clips of porn in order to, it's the right word, sensitize our brains to seeing this stuff. And also a part of the training was where there's lack of libido, low desire, well, get the couples to read a book like Nancy Friday or, of course, that's moved on. It's 50 Shades of Grey type stuff now.
Oh, I was going to say.
Or porn, in order to just get them ready, sort of. We now know that as a disastrous thing to do because we don't know which individual's brain is potentially going to gravitate to a compulsive behaviour. So is it ever a good thing? I struggle to find any good reason for advocating porn, because I often say, look, learn what this body from top of the head to the toes can do. Learn what the big toe can do before you go off and get all these gadgets from Ann Summers. The big toe, Absolutely. I'm a sex therapist. Learn what your big toe can do before you get these vibrating gadgets a man cannot compete with. I am not against vibrators and stuff like that at all. But I'm saying, before you gravitate there, get some good knowledge about the stuff of foreplay and what the whole body can do. And so we must remember, porn is not about porn. It may have started out that way, but what happened over time by going back to it repeatedly is the excitement was pumping these potent neurochemicals called dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin into the brain. And by repeatedly going back to the behaviors, when I felt bored, anxious, stressed, upset, whatever, the brain linked the two together. When you feel negative, let's go over here and let's do. And so that became the go-to in order to manage emotions. And often that gets set up in childhood. So the child actually never really learns the other coping strategies, which we all need to learn for managing emotions back in childhood. And it's still their go-to in adulthood. But over the years, the physiology of their body has changed to become use dependent on the chemicals. That's why they can't just stop when they want to stop, because they've ignored the fact that it's not just a willpower thing, it's the fact that the physiology of your body has become use dependent on these potent chemicals, which are as potent as illegal drugs. It's been shown on MRI scan. They're really potent chemicals that your body has become use dependent on. And that's why you can't just stop, even when you try to stop. It's not about the porn, it's about the chase. It's about the anticipation of the payoff that you're going to get. It's about the opportunity to turn on, click, press the mouse, the trackpad, what's on the next page. The heart is pumping, and you're getting your fix of dopamine so that. The ejaculation is often a wet squid. I do mean it as an anticlimax. I do mean it as a pun. You know, the sex with her, with the prostitute, with the escort, with masturbating, after edging and keeping it high up there for, 40 an hour, 40 minutes an hour, is often a wet squid and a disappointment because you got your fix. From the anticipation, from the chase, from the setting up the appointment and turning up, your heart is pumping those chemicals. That's your high. It's not the ejaculation often. Again, does that make sense?
No, it does. It does make sense. And what is very clear that there are causes or reasons why people are addicted to porn. It's not necessarily porn itself, but they could be going towards porn because they want to escape from psychological distress, say, or perhaps, we talked briefly, biological causes possibly. But also, if you think about the cultural norms when it comes to sex as well. And I just want to sort of touch on that a little bit as well, because as you said, you can access porn just by a click, yes, a click on your computer. And we know that children and teens are getting access to porn very
Very,
easily.
yeah, and it's a pandemic level. It is a major problem. They have no idea what they're storing up for their sexual and other relationships, even in their late teens, early 20s. Real issues, because their brain is going to become so use dependent that it's going to become sensitized from being turned on by one individual's body. For the next 5, 10 plus years, they need their fix of dining out on lots of bodies as foreplay before having sex with one person. So many of our youngsters, particularly males, are going to be experiencing periodical erectile dysfunction in their early 20s. And they're going to
Goodness.
be very embarrassed. And yet, masturbate on their own, no problem, absolutely, because it becomes situational. That's how they train their brain when they were developing in childhood. The best outcome is me, myself, and I through masturbation. And so the sex with a partner is nice, lush at the beginning, but now I need more for it to be interesting. And so the brain will just fall back on what it always knew was me, myself, and I from masturbation. That's a problem. That's a problem storing up in the sex life. But once again, they must hear there is help available. You do not need to live with the sexual dysfunctions, disorders. There's psychosexual therapy available. It's a different work to the porn addiction. Issues around the porn sex love addiction.
Because as you was explaining before, and we can go on to treatments in a minute, but what you clearly said that it can actually change your neural pathways, can't it? Where your brain is wired. But what's really beautiful about that is that you can rewire
You
your
can,
brain,
you
right?
absolutely rewire the brain, but there's no quick fix. You cannot have a quick Happy Meal McDonald's conveyor belt fix. It doesn't exist because you're not really going after porn and sex behaviors over the last 5, 10, 15. You're going after a pattern of behaviors that set the stuff up back there in childhood. Caroline, one thing I just wrote down for myself is just to remember, it's not often that an addiction is there on its own. There's often a co-addiction. So if you deal with the porn, sex, love addiction, you've got to watch the back door for an increase in, for example, alcohol intake, game consults, binge eating, or other eating disorders. Because porn isn't about porn and sex isn't about sex. It's about managing emotions. So if you get rid of one, through the back door will come another. So you've got to be watching which one's trying to come through the back door to take the place of the porn, the sex, the love addiction behavior.
Another addiction behavior. Just a little more about that, actually, that I would like to ask you. With this, do you find if people are having troubles with love, sex, and porn addiction, that they the self-soothing, yeah, so you talked about other things that accompany this addiction. Do you feel that it's used also to kind of maybe to self-soothe the feeling of guilt and shame around the addiction itself?
Oh, entirely. Let me
Okay.
give you what I call my mathematical formula. Shame plus narcissism equals sex addiction, porn addiction. Shame means hide, hidden. Don't ever let anybody find out. Don't go to a therapist. Don't share. Don't go to 12-step groups. Keep it all hidden and under wraps. And shame loves that because that's what keeps the behaviors proliferating. And then you've got this other component of narcissism. Now, don't go and look up on the internet narcissism and, oh, it's calling me a narcissist. No, it's the traits that come out of narcissism. Me, myself, and I, to put it simplistically.
See.
That's what I've learned how to do life is. And many learn masturbation as their first sexual expression. That's me, myself, and I. You see, what then happens is the individual is very much just servicing self, servicing self. It's narcissistic, so that when they see themselves as trying to help somebody, being kind, being nice, so often all roads lead back to give me something.
Right.
It's conditional. So we need to break down this thing a bit more, shame plus narcissism, because the antidote to narcissism, by the way, is empathy.
Well,
Empathy
yeah.
lifting
Self-compassion.
person. Go on.
Yeah, no, I just to add to that, the what's really important is then some of the things when you talked about self being self-compassionate, you know, being self-compassion, including that into your day-to-day thinking about yourself. But also how it comes into conflict when you have relationships, because that's one of the signs, isn't it, that your addiction is there, is that is impacting on your relationships, not only with others, but yourself.
Yes. Yeah. I love you introduced that you've introduced self-compassion, because nothing of my talk is a naughty, bad, naughty, oh, you snap on the knuckles. No, your brain gave you a coping strategy to try and help manage you through life. It's not to be beaten up, it's just it doesn't work, and it hasn't been working for a long, long time. But it is a coping strategy for managing you. We're just going to teach you a better management structure. This doesn't work. So you've got to be more kind to yourself and forgiving. It's about learning a new way. Don't keep beating yourself up. The brain was always trying to help you, but it just gave you the wrong type of thing to manage you. So self-compassion is important, but get some help. These things really don't just get better on their own. You probably need a third party to help you on your journey towards recovering from a compulsion or an addiction. There is a difference between a compulsion and an addiction, but that's for another day.
Well, absolutely, and that's why I would love to have you on again. And so, what the take home from all of what has been said today? There are causes to sex and love addiction and porn addiction, and if we look closely, and with your help, like someone like yourself, is that it's all most of it is an early life, which may include neglect or some sort of abuse or void of some sort, or in terms of relationships. But very clearly, there is a chance for you to rewire some of the your thinking, and that's leading to the addiction. If
Yes.
my listeners were to come to you, what can they expect? I know you work online as well, so it's for anyone. It's global, isn't it?
It is. I work with people abroad. One minute I might be in Qatar, I might be in Saudi Arabia, China, etc. I work with people all over the world, so I don't shout about where I am in the southwest of the country, because I work exclusively online. But I've been doing that not because of COVID. I've been working online for about 11 years now. I'm trained in online therapy. It's what I do. I've launched what's called probably the world's first full comprehensive sex, porn, love addiction recovery program, which is on my website. And that's been around for about 3 years now, where people can access it and work the program from the comfort of their home, their armchair, throughout the world. I'm just about to launch in April, maybe early May. Another video on demand program, which is for singles, pre-marrieds, couples, partners, marrieds, long, long, long time marrieds, 50 years married. You can make it better even if it's good. And that's a program I've put together from my 20 odd years and 2 books later, working with hundreds of couples, just to help people in their recovery. You can recover, you can rewind, but I'm not giving you a salesman's pitch about look what I can do. I'm a facilitator just coming alongside you, but you and your brain, with some good skills and help, you can recover from these behaviors and the addiction behaviors. But first, you've got to gain understanding and insight. And a part of that understanding then will help you move stuff from the unconscious to the conscious. What you can now see and better understand, you now get a chance to go after it. But it doesn't mean you can change it quickly, because it's had a decade start on you. So no quick fixes. And you're investing in you for the rest of your life. You're trying to move you from one trajectory, negative way you're heading, into a new trajectory. You're trying to make you the best version of you for this one that we get to live on this planet.
So, any advice really for someone to actually move forward in trying to address this? So, if they're in a relationship or they're just beginning a relationship,
Yes.
or if they've seen their teen, having trouble What would you say would be some of the first steps?
Don't feel you've got to make a commitment to some sort of therapy and long-term therapy, etc., etc. Just have a 1 hour initial consultation. You can have that with me, where I would answer, the therapist would answer all of your questions, give you informed knowledge, and out of that, make your decisions whether you do something after that or you don't do something. But get understanding is really what I offer to you. Have that 1 hour consultation and then decide what you do or don't do. But you have the potential to move your life from one way it's heading into a whole different trajectory for the rest of your life. Be the best that you can be, but it will cost you financially and in time. You can't have a quick fix. It doesn't exist, the quick fix, because you're rewiring your brain, really.
And any investment is a good investment if it's good for you, and this is good for you, obviously, because it's going to change certain things that you've been finding quite challenging to cope with. It's, as you said, it's more than just the love and the sex and the porn. There are things to uncover. Any parting words for my listeners?
Be the best that you can be and bring colour back to life without shame. We know these particular behaviours get handed on like a script, like a baton to the next generation, i.e., the children. It does. And so, actually, this is way bigger than just you. It's about, no, this has to stop with me and not get passed on to the next generation. I hope you see that as an incentive for some of you to think about taking next step and doing something. Do something. Don't just listen to these words and continue life as usual. But of course, your brain's going to talk you out of things. You can kick this when you need to kick it, when you want to, when you really, really try, can't you? So
Absolutely.
have lived there for 5, 10, 15 years. Get some help
Get
from
some help.
yeah.
Yeah. Can you share your details so my listeners know where to contact you?
Yes, Kairos is KAIROS. Kairos actually is a Greek word for your appointed time.
Ah, perfect.
Isn't that interesting? And so you can find me just by putting in the word Kairos hyphen Center, Centre. I think is that the English or American way, but it's TRE. So kairos-center.com, and you can email me info at kairos-center.com. But my website's got a lot of material. I've got a podcast out there, the Sex, Porn, and Love Addiction podcast. You'll get that on all the podcast outlets, just like your own. You can listen to some of the podcasts, you can listen to some of the YouTube stuff that I've put out there, coming out of the recovery program. So you can check me out, so to speak, from some of those things. But it's something that I've been doing for a lot of years with hundreds and hundreds of many others, and it's a tried and tested program that does work.
And as he mentioned before, Gary mentioned before, he works with men, women, and couples, and single people as well. Yeah, is that correct?
Yeah, I just don't work with those probably under about 18 children because you need an extra type of training to work with children and insurance as well. So I don't have the skills to work with children, but I leave those to some others that are perhaps much more competent than me.
Well, Gary's details shall be on the podcast description. Thank you so much, Gary, for coming on the Crazy Over 40s Life podcast.
A privilege, can I?
Thank you. you, Gary, for coming on once again. You can get hold of all my guests, as always, Instagram, Facebook, Gmail, thecrazyoverforceslife.com website, which shall continue to explore sexual wellness and sexual development. On the next episode, we shall be joined by Dr. Tara, who's a tenured professor of relational and sexual communication at California State University. She's also an award-winning researcher and relationship coach at lovebites.co. She also has a podcast at Love Bites, Dr. Tara Podcast. She shall be here telling us exactly how we can embrace our sexual wellness and what that actually means today in the over 40s. Listen to this and more. I'm your host, Caroline Brown. And don't forget to share and subscribe so you can keep updated on all the episodes as and when they become available.